You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. Welcome to it. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for joining us on the radio. And, of course, we're on Twitter, at KUOW. In Washington State, if you've been raped, you have 3 years to pursue charges after the crime happens. You get 10 years if you filed a police report within the first year of the rape happening. We have one of the shortest statutes of limitations for rape in the United States. And now some lawmakers in Olympia want to change that. Reporter Hayat Noreen-Mine wrote about this for the Seattle Met's Publicola. Hayat, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
How would this bill change the current law?
Yeah, so it would remove the statute of limitations for serious felony sex offenses like rape. So right now, if you've been raped and you would have 3 years to pursue charges against your attacker, with this bill, you or prosecuting attorneys can choose to file rape charges at any time, no matter how long it's been since the crime.
Why do we have this relatively short statute of limitations in Washington State?
Yeah, so the idea is that with as more time passes, the harder it is to prosecute someone for rape, especially because memory fades and physical evidence fades. So that's generally the idea as to why some prosecuting attorneys are generally wary of removing the statute altogether. That they think that there should be some form of statute of limitations for rape, even if it's not 3 years.
Do these prosecutors say that the statute of limitations encourages survivors to come forward earlier rather than later when it's harder to prove?
I think that's generally the idea, yes. They want survivors to come forward earlier rather than later because... you know, the longer you wait, the harder it's going to be to remember the crime, especially for something like rape, where you can argue that there hasn't been a crime, that can be part of the defense as opposed to murder, for example. There's a body, there's clear evidence that shows that a crime has occurred, whereas with rape, that can be a little more fuzzy.
And what's the argument being made by people who want to at least shorten the statute of limitations for rape and felony sex offenses?
Yeah, as the whole Harvey Weinstein Me Too campaign has highlighted, there's a lot of reasons that rape survivors don't come forward about the crime when it happens. Sometimes there's a power dynamic involved. A lot of women I've spoken to say that there's a lot of shame and fear. A lot blame themselves. A lot have really disheartening reactions from friends and family members when they do come forward. And when they do come forward and it goes to a trial, that experience can be really unpleasant as well. So advocates are saying that it's important to encourage survivors to come forward, especially because rape and sexual assault is the most underreported crime in the nation. So this is just to say, you know, we want to hear from you. That's what advocates say.
In fact, you're reporting on the story of a convicted serial rapist in Bellingham who was accused by 9 women of rape and 1 of sexual assault. Eventually, he was sentenced to 2 years in prison. Why are you looking at that story in particular?
Yeah, so my story is about the statute of limitations for rape and what role it plays in prosecuting. So in this recent case in Bellingham against this co-owner of a restaurant who turned out to be a serial rapist, some people in the community knew he had this reputation, but it was never reported to law enforcement. And then back in 2015, all these accusations started coming out of the woodwork on social media. Prosecuting attorneys pursued charges, and ultimately 10 women came forward. 5 of them, their statute of limitations for rape had passed at that point, and they just came forward in solidarity of the more recent women who've been raped by him. So one argument for removing this statute is just the serial nature of the crime. If there's someone who's been raping women or raping people, it's likely that they haven't just raped one person, that they've been raping people on for several years. So, this removing the statute would have strengthened in the case against Jameson Rogayan in Bellingham, at least would have strengthened that case against him.
And finally, Hayat, this is a bipartisan bill in the Washington State House, but this bill was around last year and it didn't pass the Senate. What is behind this year's push for it?
Yeah, advocates are saying that now, after this national reckoning with sexual assault and rape, that they expect this bill to be more successful this time around. And it seems like the right time to push this.
We'll find out as the legislative session begins here. Lawmakers will be discussing that bill this month during the upcoming legislative session, talking about shortening, or rather, we have one of the shortest statutes of limitations for rape in the United States, and we're talking about changing that in Olympia. We've been talking about it with the associate editor for the Seattle Met's Publicola, Hayat Norimine. Thanks a lot for this.
Thank you.
And you're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Back in just a moment. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. After Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico last fall, we met a Seattle woman who still had not heard from her mother. Fern Marie Rodriguez grew up on the island, and after the storm, she went online and rented her father a Jeep, which he drove across the island to find her mother. He did find her, and she's okay. But Fern Marie told us about the people who were not okay.
The situation is pretty horrific. People are in need of water, food, gasoline, electricity, communication. There's absolutely nothing that is left for them. Some people have lost everything, absolutely everything.
Now, after we spoke about 3.5 months ago, Fern Marie Rodriguez went about trying to bring her mother here to Seattle. Fern Marie, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
First of all, how's your mother?
She's doing okay. She was... I purchased a flight for her because at the time she still did not have electricity. Even today, what's the 10th of January, folks in the center of the island still do not have electricity. So I didn't have a way to communicate with her. So I purchased a ticket for her and told my brother to go let her know that she was exiting the island. It was a little devastating for her. And when I mean a little, it's she's going through a little bit of a shock having lived there her whole life and come out of the tropical island and into the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah. Would you mind? I mean, this is her business, but if you are comfortable, I'd like to know more about what that shock is. What is she going through?
Well, anything from what you eat to what you wear to not knowing who to talk to. She doesn't speak English. So even trying to meet her neighbors, she has to have me or my brother translate.
Do you get the impression that she's traumatized in any way from what she went through in Puerto Rico?
I think it's safe to say that millions of people are traumatized. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you consider that today, almost 4 months afterwards, you have 40% of the island who still have no electricity. Their basic lifestyle has collapsed. Just imagine us, right? Like in our lifetime, we've never experienced something over 100 days without electricity. And when that happens, your entire life collapses. You can't go to work. You can't sustain your family. You have no way of contacting other people. You have to, if you're, especially the folks that are in medical need, are suffering tremendously in the island.
You still have other family. You brought your mother and your youngest brother. Are you two brothers?
You brought
one of them here.
Yeah.
But tell us about your family who's still on the island.
Yeah. So my oldest brother is still there. Most of my aunts and uncles have done an exodus as well to other states. But there are people that don't have relatives outside of the island, and they are stuck there with the situation. So to answer your question with regards to other family members, so my brother has electricity, and his employer had electricity, so he didn't have a need to exit. But he tells me every day that the situation is pretty dire for his neighbors, for people that don't have the resources to go out and charge their phones or their laptops somewhere else, or not even have the opportunity to pay their bills, right? So it's just an incredible situation in our lifetime.
When you visited us mm-hmm. about 3 months ago, you were just beginning to set up relief aid,
yeah.
organizing Microsoft coworkers and mm-hmm. others. First of all, why not leave that to groups like the Red Cross?
Because why not? I felt like I was in a perfect opportunity, in a perfect position to do something about it. And the Red Cross, my dad works for the Red Cross in the island, by the way. And he was telling me, we're not sending people. It's too dangerous. There's a lot of, as great as the Red Cross is, there's red tape because you can't send people and endanger your employees, which makes sense. But when your family is the one that needs the help, you will risk your life.
Yeah.
So I would risk my life. So I felt that we were in a perfect opportunity to make a difference. So I partnered with a nonprofit organization, 501c3, here, the Puerto Rican Association of Washington State. And they were so gracious to allow me to have a Microsoft attorney put in the paperwork so that we become an umbrella organization. We're called Puerto Rico We Care. We raised over 40,000 pounds of donations from the Seattle community, restaurants, La Isla restaurant, and just about 100 volunteers from Seattle came together to find this aid. And then we were stuck with the situation of how do we send it? So Costco was gracious enough to grant a $50,000 container that they just gave us. We filled it up with 27 pallets. Two of the pallets came directly from the Children's Hospital. Everyone was willing to help. 1,500 pounds of medical supplies were sent directly from the Children's Hospital to the main medical center, Centro Médico, in San Juan. In addition to that, Kent Solar donated 7,000 pounds of solar panels that we also literally just delivered a week and a half ago. The whole thing took forever to get through. The port in San Juan had 5,000 containers that they had to go through. So
what was the biggest surprise for you in suddenly becoming an umbrella relief, hurricane relief organizer? What surprised you the most through all of that?
One of the most beautiful things is to see that people are willing to help. Our community, just people like you and me, they're willing to help. Sometimes they don't know how, and we gave them the venue to help. Now, I want to also add, Microsoft employees were highly gracious. In Microsoft alone, we raised over $240,000 from employees, just people that want to contribute and want to help. So we gave them the venue to help. Sometimes people just don't know what to do, but they want to do something.
Now, Fern Marie, this is just a side note that I'd like to bring into this, to your story. You have a job at Microsoft that's made more difficult, I imagine, because you're dealing with your family in Puerto Rico. You're setting up hurricane relief. And by the way, you also made a trip to Orlando, Florida, where the World Latin Dance Cup was happening, and you wanted to compete in it. And how did that go for you?
Well, I had actually trained for 3 years.
Yeah.
This was, the hurricane was not in plan for me.
Yes.
So I had practiced and trained to compete for the first time in December. So December came about. I wasn't sure if I was going to compete. I had not practice since September.
I would imagine.
So I told my instructor, John Narvaez from San Francisco, I told him, I'm going to go to your house and I'm going to train for 2 weeks. And then we're going to go to the competition and we're going to just wing it. And whatever happens, happens. And I am a world champion.
You won the World Latin Dance Cup. I am a world champion, says Fern Marie Rodriguez. You're laughing.
Well, because it's a little surreal. I couldn't even conceive of the thought of practicing when the hurricane situation was happening.
Of course.
And I just said, it's an easy choice. I don't have to even consider the championship because it's not relevant anymore. I just want my family to be okay. I just want to help. And once everything was established, it was 2 weeks away from competing. On December 4th, I flew to San Francisco. And on the 16th, I became a world champion.
Did the whole hurricane story and your mother, did any of that figure into this dance competition in any way? The stress, that did you get to tell your story as part of it? Were they connected?
No.
Or was this a completely different world?
Completely different world. There were 40 countries represented. I was the only person from Puerto Rico. So it gave
really?
Me more strength, more desire.
Was that because so many people couldn't make it? They had to dash their
You
plan.
Can imagine,
yeah.
right? So last year, there were a number of Puerto Ricans that made it to the competition. This year, that's not where the mind is. They're in an emergency mode.
I see.
So I was the only person representing my island and stood proud with my flag, only person on stage when they said Puerto Rico. And
standing ovation?
No, well, people didn't know. People kind of forget, which is why I'm so grateful for you having invited me today, because you didn't forget.
You reached
out and you said, hey,
yeah,
we spoke 3 months ago. How is it going?
Yes.
So thank you for not forgetting.
Well, thank you for coming back and telling your story. So I want to hear a little more about you, about your family. First of all, I just want to know what happens next when you're a world Latin dance champion. Do you do TV competition? Do you tour the stage show? Is your bye-bye
no.
Microsoft? I have a new light. What
no,
happened?
Okay. This is my hobby.
Okay.
And
this is the kind of story that launches a political career, by the way, just in case you're interested. People who do amazing, famous things can...
My instructor jokes and he says to us, because we're a company, he's an extension of San Francisco, is here in Seattle, and he tells us, you guys dance as if you're getting paid for it. Just chill. We do not get paid for it.
Yeah.
It's a hobby. And it's just putting your heart and mind and focus into something that you're passionate about, be it suddenly becoming a founder of a nonprofit,
yeah.
or becoming a world champion, or lighting up everyone in Seattle with fantastic stories every day, right?
Oh.
So whatever your passion is, just go for it.
Fern Marie, what does your mom think of life in Seattle, and how long will she stay here?
We do not know how long she will stay, but I can tell you, for my mom and my brothers, they're going through a cultural shock. I think that anyone who has moved from a foreign country to the United States, even I remember moving into the United States in 2003, and I remember being depressed for a year because of the cultural shock. Everything is different. The language is different. The food is different. The people are different. It's just the way you interact. Everything.
How are the people different? What's shock number
one? So, for example, I'll tell you my experience when I moved here. We greet people with a kiss. This just in our culture. And I remember going to work and being embarrassed because I approached someone and they got scared. And
male or female?
Female coworker.
Okay.
And she just got scared that
yeah.
I approached her to greet her with a kiss. And after that, you never do it again. But little things like that. And I know
they say Seattle freeze. They don't say Seattle kiss as much. It's not as much of a thing here.
People in Seattle are particularly reserved.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she's 58, right? She lived her entire life in a tropical setting. We would get lunch from grabbing taro roots from the backyard or grabbing bananas from the backyard. And she doesn't have that anymore. So that's just an example. It's just a cultural shock.
How long do you think she'll stay with you here?
I'm hopeful that she can assimilate and she can stay from now on.
You and she don't want her to return to Puerto Rico?
It's not that I don't want her to return. It's just that there's the situation on the island is so dire right now.
Mm-hmm.
Her entire city is without electricity still. So what would you do there? You can't have... Oh, and then let's not forget how hot it is in Puerto Rico, right? Mm-hmm. So even right now, if you look at the temperature, it's like 90 degrees or 95 degrees. So it's a tropical island in the near the equator, 17 degrees north of the equator. It's hot. And there's no way to cool down. So that's one of the things that the people have mentioned, just having a glass of water. I have heard people cry when they get a cold drink because they haven't had it for over 100 days. So it's not that I want her to stay. I do want her to stay. I just want her to be happy. That's all I want for her. Whatever that is.
One more question, if I can, Fern Marie. When you were here in October, you told us about all the devastation that we've been describing. And then right after that, you barely took a breath before you told us beautiful stories of people helping each other. I remember washing their hair in ponds and smiling. What does that say to you?
I continue to see the beautiful stories. Just one, like a week ago, I saw Eminem.
The rapper Eminem?
No. Eminem Mars, the candy company.
The candy, yeah.
Mm-hmm. They sponsored a song for Puerto Ricans. So Puerto Ricans are happy people. And our Christmas is a parade, literally, like pots and pans and noise and drums. And just you literally invade someone's home at 2 in the morning, parading, literally parading. We call them parrandas. And Eminem did a tribute to Puerto Rico and said, well, you may not have electricity, but we'll light up candles and we're still going to go invade your homes. And it was so beautiful to see like an American company sympathizing with an entire culture and trying to make it a little bit more soothing and peaceful and happy. And in the end, you still see a little bit of everything. Right now, after 100 days, almost 4 months without electricity, you see in the news, like the first female that became chief officer in the island resigned because it's just so stressful for the law enforcement in the island. So you will see a little bit of everything. People are becoming desperate. At the same time, you see the culture still being there. You still see light. You still see people smiling. And I hope that something great, it will eventually come out of the devastation that happened there. Even if it's people just discovering that happiness is within themselves and just attaching and leeching on to that until Puerto Rico blooms again. Becomes green again.
Fern Marie Rodriguez, her family in Puerto Rico was hit with the rest of the island by Hurricane Maria 3.5 months ago or so, this last fall, and she decided to get her mother and her brother out of there, and she did that. They're here in Seattle now, and she decided to help the people of Puerto Rico, and she became an organizer, a relief aid organizer. And thank you for all of that. And we wish the best for you and your family, your mom, and the island. And thanks for everything you've done.
Thank you for having me here, sharing the story.
This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. We're on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Who gets to be president of the United States? Politicians, mostly. Maybe someone with military experience. Business people have tried. Add to that the celebrity, President Donald Trump. Why stop there? You got your President Tom Hanks, right? And President The Rock. And leading the pack after this weekend, President Oprah. Here she is accepting a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Golden Globes.
I've interviewed and portrayed people who've withstood some of the ugliest things life can throw at you. But the one quality all of them seem to share is an ability to maintain hope for a brighter morning, even during our darkest nights. So I want all the girls watching here and now to know that a new day is on the horizon. And when that new day finally dawns, it will be because of a lot of magnificent women, many of whom are right here in this room tonight, and some pretty phenomenal men fighting hard to make sure that they become the leaders who take us to the time when nobody ever has to say "Me Too" again. Thank you.
Pretty much by the time that applause ended, the Oprah for President conversation had begun, and America was arguing about whether celebrities with no political experience can successfully run our government. Well, we're going to have that conversation now on KUOW. First, I asked presidential historian and University of Washington professor Margaret O'Meara about this country's history with all this.
The fixation on celebrity politicians isn't new. I dial back to the beginning of the 20th century and think of Theodore Roosevelt as the, you know, most famous man in America who also happened to be president. And then after he was president, he was in some ways even more famous, both for his what he actually accomplished, but more for his force of personality, his ability to give newspaper reporters really great quotes, and for the kind of mythology he actively cultivated around himself as this rugged adventurer who was either storming up San Juan Hill in the Spanish-American War or wrestling with bears in the American West or going on safari in Africa.
Okay, so Teddy Roosevelt was a celebrity, and there have been others. Then what is the lesson for us wondering what this says, that to be president, you've got to be TV famous fabulous or something?
I don't think so. I think what it says right now is that first, Donald Trump running and winning the presidency kind of changed the calculus in terms of, wow, someone who is a celebrity, who's never had a day of government experience, could win the presidency. So it's part of this electoral calculus of like, wow, someone maybe like Oprah could be a viable candidate. It also speaks to this hunger for someone, this hunger among the Trump opposition, one that spans all the way from kind of the far left to the mainstream Democrats to the never Trumpers in the Republican Party, to find someone who could be a viable opponent to Donald Trump in 2020. And that singular personality has not risen yet from the ranks of the Democratic Party. So I think this in part speaks to this casting about of, you know, who is going to be the person who runs against Trump in 2020. And that answer is not yet quite clear.
Can I float a theory past you and you can pop it, maybe?
Sure.
Americans imagine the president is supremely important and should be all-knowing, when actually every president is dwarfed by events and a giant government structure, and it's harder to predict any president's success, insider or outsider. It's harder to predict their success than we imagine. What do you think?
You're absolutely right. It is very hard to predict who is going to be a successful president. The presidents that are most highly regarded by historians are often people who happen to be in office when moments of great crisis happened and they had to wrestle with that crisis. You know, example number one is Abraham Lincoln. I mean, talk about someone who was not made for television. Abraham Lincoln kind of didn't have the looks or the voice or the charisma that one would imagine. And he also was someone that many people, you know, he's a polarizing figure. His election precipitated a civil war, but he rose to the challenge. So, and the same goes with, you know, again, think about our quote unquote greatest presidents. They were often presidents who governed in times of war and times of great economic crisis and helped the United States weather that storm.
So then what is your advice to us as we ponder Oprah 2020?
I think it's time to take a deep breath. And I think Oprah Winfrey has a pretty great life and has a pretty is an extremely influential person without running for office. Her brand is built on having an appeal that crosses over political boundaries. You know, Fox News watchers and MSNBC News fans are both fans of Oprah. And becoming a partisan political figure doesn't seem like it would be in her best interest. I think that we need to think about what does it take to be president? Yes, you do need to be someone who can be a compelling, charismatic, convincing inspiring figure who rallies a large swath of the electorate around a common purpose. Someone who, like Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who, you know, during the Great Depression and World War II kind of rallied the nation through his communication skills. Now, he was someone who also had his many political detractors. But again, you need to have that communication ability, but you also need to have a coherent political ideology, a sense of what you want to accomplish in office, and know that you need to surround yourself with people who can advise you and show you how to get it done.
That's Margaret O'Meara, presidential historian, University of Washington history professor, joining us, talking about what the Oprah 2020 conversation says about America and politics and culture. And now joining us in the studio, Seattle Times columnist Nicole Broder. Good to see you again, Nicole.
Good to see you, Bill.
You just wrote about this. You don't like the idea of Oprah 2020 much, and why is that?
I just think it's a little reckless. I think that I understand completely how desperately we needed the kind of speech, the kind of oratory, and the kind of inspiration that she gave us at the Golden Globes. She delivered, we needed this after, you know, a year of tweets and taunts and half sentences and just, you know, division in the country. She was able to really, she put together a beautiful speech. She just, what did someone say? She took us to church, basically. And she's an accomplished, amazing woman. That doesn't make her president. I think that the soil in which to plant this seed of Oprah was pretty rich, especially after Fire and Fury came out last week. And we've just been sort of hungry for what she gave us. And I think we kind of lost our minds a little bit. People are losing their minds.
Well, she's inexperienced. We don't know what her platform would be and how she'd campaign, much less how she would. But she's run a big giant business. She's a billionaire, et cetera.
She can bring the right people in, and she can get it all done. And she's an extremely intelligent, savvy woman. And absolutely, you can do that. But I am a firm believer in a president who is a more studied, has aimed for politics, has more of a, she is a public service person. She does a lot of things for people who need help. She's on the ground at, you know, Katrina, any number of places. I mean, Oprah's around. She's no Jesse Jackson, who was always everywhere all the time. But she has a sense of the people, you know, which is worth a lot, too. But she's not prepared for this. She hasn't studied this. I don't know. Maybe she's poring over every presidential biography that's ever been written. But
she's got 3 years.
She's got 3 years, but I still don't think that's enough. The presidents that I admire are ones who were involved in civic life as children, almost in high school, and, you know, aimed at this and went to school for this and trained and did, you know, neighborhood, small town, you know, consensus building work on this, you know, hard, you know, shoe leather work as politician in politics or in public life and, you know, public service. I think that Oprah's probably done some measure of those things in her life, but, you know, I like her, frankly, right where she is. I want to have a big personality who's speaking for, all kinds of issues with endless freedom. She's got all the freedom in the world, and I think she should keep it because the presidency will not allow her to do that.
Also joining us on the line, Politico contributing editor Bill Scherer, also host of the DMZ podcast. Bill, welcome to KUOW.
Good to be here.
The Democratic representative from California, Jackie Speier, tweeted, "Run, Oprah, run. An army of women would fight for you." Let's start with the Electoral College. Would Oprah Winfrey win the presidency?
Well, that's a big jump to make as we sit today. There was a poll that just came out that showed her beating Trump by 10 points. And with that kind of lead, you probably would win the Electoral College. Democrats have been weak with white voters.
We're losing you, Bill. If you can move around, we might get a better cell connection. Will you start that again?
Oh, I'm
I got you now.
Sorry, do you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Okay.
Go on.
The Democrats have been weak with white voters, particularly white working class voters, Oprah has spent her career building a bond with female white working class voters. So it's not implausible to think that she could do better in some of those Rust Belt states that Hillary Clinton had a hard time with. Now, she has to be vetted. She would need to have positions on Yemen and positions on financial deregulation and positions on global trade. Who knows what improprieties might be lurking in her various philanthropic foundations. So it's not like you can assume it's going to be a glide path for her.
Of course.
But beyond the basic attributes of her celebrity and wealth, she has unique attributes. Roseanne Barr ran for president, didn't do very well. Being a celebrity is not nearly enough. Her kind of celebrity is akin to Trump's. It's a self-help celebrity. It is a self-improvement relationship she's had with the public for a very long time, and that could break through a lot of political barriers.
And something, you're right, by the way, to state the obvious, there are so many things between now and President Oprah that it would be absurd to think we're talking about where we're handicapping a presidential campaign. But I'm trying to surface the most interesting thing about things about this national conversation we're having. And one thing that stands out to me about Oprah Winfrey is that most politicians who have passionate fans also have passionate enemies. And I can't think, who doesn't like Oprah Winfrey? Isn't that an important factor?
Are you asking me?
Both of you.
I guess the meat industry or the cattle industry, didn't she get in some trouble? I guess then. Whoever's trying not going against Weight Watchers, I don't know. I can't name her enemies. I mean, you know.
But once she steps into the political arena, she will get enemies. She's above the fray today. As soon as she's a politician, it's a whole other story. The Republican attack machine will gear up. And part of the test would be, how do you handle that? Show me what you do. And this is true for any Democrat running. I mean, Obama cleared his last test in 2008 when the Jeremiah Wright flap occurred. And he gave the more that made Democrats say, okay, this guy knows how to handle it when he's put through the ringer. Oprah got the show, she knows how to handle it if that day came.
So, Nicole, I don't know. Do you want to tell us your politics and what we're assuming Oprah's politics? I'm guessing she seems kind of mainstream Democrat to me.
Yeah.
But yeah. So, as I'm wondering, is this political at all for you? If you thought that Oprah Winfrey were the one most likely to, if you wanted to vote Democrat and thought Oprah Winfrey was the most likely to beat the Republican nominee, are you saying you wouldn't vote for her because, celebrity culture, I just can't bring myself to do it?
Like I said, that would be a reckless thing to do.
Yeah.
I trust that, you know, if she got in, no problem. She could handle it. She'd get all the right people. I would be inspired by her. She could go to other countries and I wouldn't be embarrassed by her. I think she has grace and tact and decency. If she was the only choice I had, I would totally vote for her.
Okay.
I mean, but I'm hoping and I believe that our country has more than a talk show host slash billionaires slash, you know, she's an amazing entrepreneur. We have more than this.
Well, let's get at that. Politico's Bill Scherr, do you agree with or how concerned are you about a talk show host president, another novice, as Nicole is saying, not a history of being a scholar of American government, much less a politician, et cetera. How much of a downside is that to you?
Well, the Democratic primary process is going to be a year and a half process. People are going to be put through their paces. People have run for the office before who don't have long resumes. You know, Obama's resume was much shorter than Hillary Clinton's in 2008, for example. But if you show your stuff on stage, there's going to be 10, 20 debates probably. You'd have to prove that you have a deep understanding of the material if you're going to get through. Now, maybe you'd say, well, Trump didn't. But I think the Republican electorate has a different sensibility than the Democratic electorate. They're going to expect to see some specifics on policies and so forth. So she'd have to prove herself. But on the same token, every other Democrat running is going to probably be 10 to 15 of them. They don't only have to prove themselves on the policy front, but also on the charisma front. And look, I think you could beat Donald Trump without charisma. I think you could, if Trump's at 35%, you could put a potted plant against them and they'd probably win. But to get out of that Democratic primary when there's 15 people, someone's going to have to light up the electorate in a way that encourages people to get out to vote.
But
and
Bill,
if you're going up against an Oprah, you better have some charisma yourself to match hers.
Bill, I think the even bigger conversation that we're having here in this country is, how do you feel about the idea of celebrity culture, reality TV show culture, taking over our politics? I mean, when Donald Trump ran, and I remember this from Ronald Reagan and others, the big concern is we are sliding toward a, remember the movie Idiocracy, you know, that you just you have to be a reality TV star to run the United States of America. Are you troubled by that in no way, Bill?
I wouldn't say in no way, but it's not so much how I feel personally. I think there is something in human nature that is attracted to celebrity. We've already had Governor Schwarzenegger. We've had Governor Jesse the Body Ventura. It's not just America. The five-star movement in Italy is run by a comedian. The president of Guatemala, Jimmy Morales, was a comedian. Voters tend to be attracted to certain kinds of celebrity. And I just can't pretend that doesn't exist in society. We want to obviously mitigate it so it's not only celebrity that makes you qualify for the presidency, but we just can't pretend that people don't care for that sort of thing, especially in an age where you're seeing people on TV and are attracted to personalities. That's just a fact of life.
Well, what about that, Nicole? This is just, yes, we human beings have always loved a good story, loved celebrity. We're fixated on the president. There's only one, but actually there's a giant sea of government underneath them. So what if it's just time to give in, like it or not? People, not just Americans, yeah, we love a good, exciting figurehead,
yeah, but
that's the way it is.
What does that say about us, though, that we're that easy, that we're just going to say, okay, I know you. I watched you on TV every day at 3 o'clock for however many years.
Maybe that's just the human brain, and let's deal with that.
Well, there's something to being known and understood. And, you know, we all know Oprah, and we trust her, and her Q ratio or Q whatever that thing is, I'm sure is through the roof. You know, she's the new gold standard. She's the gold standard for a celebrity. You know, she's a principled, you know, decent person. But I, you know, as opposed to other celebrities out there, I just want more. I want a scholar. I want someone who has studied presidents before and studied how government works and knows how government works and has fought for policy. And
who is that person now in the Democratic field who also is charismatic enough to win the presidency?
I don't know, Diane. Well, there are a lot of people we haven't given a shot to. Diane, you know, Hillary, you know, this man with me said, you know, that President Obama didn't have a lot of experience. Hillary Clinton had too much. So you have to kind of hit this sweet spot in the middle and figure out who's been there, who's been there for the big fights, who's been there to, who's made a mark. And I think that Obama kind of came into his cult of celebrity, his cult of personality. He grew into that job. He became more, charismatic and as time
presidential.
Went on. Yeah, and presidential. And but there was something more, you know. Look at how Pete Souza's book was received here. And in
this was the former White House
photographer
for Obama.
People went crazy for it, and they miss him desperately. But he had the goods, and then he became this more of a figurehead, so to speak. So I'm trying to go back to the question. I want someone who has been working toward this for their entire lives. I think it's, you know, yeah. Who do we have?
My question was, yeah, then who? Because you could say that. What does this say about?
We have a little time, but you know, a lot of people have come in later on. You know, we still have a little bit of time to really grow. I think the Democrats are still picking themselves up off the floor and trying to figure out what the hell to do. But you know, today was good because Trump had everybody in the room and we could see how things work. And I wish they did that all the time so we knew what's going on over there.
Okay, last words. Politico contributing editor Bill Scheer, what's this about? What's the lesson here this week from the Oprah 2020 conversation?
Well, the lesson is Democrats are starving for a winner. They have been psyched out that they got beat by Donald Trump, who they didn't respect going in. And they do feel a little bit desperate right now, perhaps more desperate than they need to be, considering how Trump is doing at the polls right now. So there is a desire for a quick fix, an easy answer. And there is no easy answer. People are going to have to go through their paces. Oprah could well be the answer, but you can't assume just because she gave one good speech that that's the end of the story.
Bill Scheer from Politico, contributing editor there, and also with the podcast DMZ. Thanks a lot, Bill.
My pleasure.
Good to talk with you. Nicole Broder from the Seattle Times on Facebook. There's a conversation about this at our Facebook page. And Laura says, love Oprah, not qualified to be president. I've had my fill of an unqualified business, quotes, business person in the White
Thank
House.
Thank you, Laura.
Would love to see her start out in local politics, though. So,
yeah.
Mayor of Chicago?
Listen, no. Well, yeah, if she wants to, but I love her just where she is.
Yeah.
I love her voice and her strength and her money. I mean, she can help other candidates that we really believe in.
Seattle Times columnist Nicole Broder, one of many people weighing in on and thinking, what's going on here? What is Oprah 2020? What is this even idea that this has captured our imaginations? What does it say about
us
today?
We're fighting fire with fire.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think it was someone said maybe it takes a celebrity to beat a celebrity.
Maybe.
Anyway, more to come. Nicole, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Bill.
Good to see you. The Record on KUOW, 94.9 Seattle. Join the conversation on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KUOW, and we'll be back in a moment. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW. When Attorney General Jeff Sessions said he would stop protecting states with legalized marijuana, it set off big uncertainties for local pot growers, distributors, sellers, smokers, and for Canadians, which surprised me. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, welcome.
Hello, Bill.
I know that Canada is legalizing marijuana soon itself, but why is Canada so involved in our marijuana industry and struggles and debates?
Well, it shook up the Canadian stock market for a couple of days.
I saw that.
Here's the deal. You've got Canadian companies that are producing marijuana here in Canada and listed on the Canadian stock exchanges. And some of those companies also have interests in the United States. And there are American companies involved in producing marijuana that have partners in Canada, and they're raising money here as well. So we have a cross-border trade in investment in marijuana, although I caution to say nobody is planning on doing anything as stupid as trying to bring the product back and forth across the border, because that's illegal. But the markets have kind of corrected themselves a bit, but I'll tell you, Canadian securities regulators are warning companies, both Canadian and American, if you're trying to raise money in Canada for investment in marijuana production, be aware that it is against the law in the United States, against federal law, and it's not out of the question that it could be designated as the proceeds of crime. Nobody thinks that's going to happen, Bill, but it is a risk, and the Canadian Securities Exchange is requiring anyone raising money on Canadian Stock Exchange to warn investors about the legal situation in the United States.
Does any of this affect border crossings?
I think it does, yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting. It's also the Sessions thing. I mean, the Sessions, as you know, it was just a memo. It wasn't U.S. law
right.
That prevented prosecutions. It was a policy decision, and it's now been rescinded.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing, and Canadian governments have taken the occasion to warn Canadians again. We're going to legalization this summer in Canada, here in British Columbia. The B.C. government is warning British Columbians, don't take it for granted that you can just go across the border. For heaven's sakes, don't take the product across the border. You'll get stopped and arrested and charged. But even answering the question, have you ever smoked marijuana, can get you blocked from entry into the United States because it's still illegal. And there's every reason to think that whatever the Sessions memo does in terms of dealings between the federal government in the United States and California and Washington and Colorado, there's every reason to think that it will be even tougher getting back and forth across the border. And Canada's Canadian government has already said on the record that if there's any sign that this change in direction in the national government in the States makes border crossings more difficult back and forth from Canada, the Canadian government will be filing an official protest with the U.S. government.
A lot of people still don't know the upshot of answering that question honestly at the border.
Yeah. Well, you should tell the truth.
Right.
But one of the best pieces of legal advice I heard was that it is not a valid question, and you can say, I don't answer that question. Lying is not a good idea, but telling the truth can get you banned. So saying I don't answer that question and seeing what happens is one possibility. Of course, not everybody gets asked the question either, right? I mean, from what I've heard, the anecdotal evidence, they tend to pick on younger people or people going down for music festivals or, you know, if you're dumb enough to have a legalized pot sticker on your on the bumper of your car, that sort of thing. But they may just be in a bad mood and ask you the question.
Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer with a Canadian reaction to the conversation we're having here this week, thanks to Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Vaughn, good to talk with you. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Bill.
And thank you for tuning into The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle, put together by Amina Al-Sadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Yandel. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening. My guest tomorrow, Governor Jay Inslee. If you've got a question for him, email us record@kuow.org.